From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It sounds good on paper. Adoptive parents shouldn't choose their children based on race. But a new report says that colorblind adoption can be problematic. We've got two perspectives on the issue. We'll talk to a young African-American man who was adopted into a white family. But first, we have Holly McGinnis, Policy and Operations Director at the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute. Holly, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
So, tell me a little bit about this new report you've done.
This is a very timely paper. I'm sure many people don't know, but there are essentially three different laws that are governing transracial adoptions in the United States. We just signed on to the Hague Convention for International Adoptions, which stipulate that preservation of one's culture and heritage is important and requires 15 hours of prospective adoptive parent training. We have the Indian Child Welfare Act, which specifically stipulates that Native American children should remain within their communities of origin. And then we have the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act, which basically applies a colorblind approach to the adoption of children of color from the foster care system. And so our paper was really focusing on that specific act and taking a lot of the social science research and also looking at the hard numbers. The intention of the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act was to move more children of color into permanency, into permanent homes. And unfortunately, in the decade that the law has been on the paper, that just has not been happening. And so our paper is really looking at that problem.
Now, when you say that problem, what would you like to see changed specifically?
Well, specifically, we are requesting that that the adoption agencies are freed up so that they can prepare those parents who are adopting transracially. I think the key thing I need to emphasize is that we are not saying that transracial adoptions do not work. And in fact, the majority of the social science indicates that many transracial adoptees do very, very well. And but we are also seeing that there is a need to address the realities of our society, which include a race consciousness. And so we would like to bring that into the child welfare system as well and just say we need to be conscious of race. We need to be able to at least talk about it. Absolutely, we're not going to make race be the sole factor in terms of deciding a placement, but it does need to be a consideration.
Are you talking here about legal changes or cultural changes or both?
Ideally, it would be both, but right now the biggest impediment is the federal law, the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act, and its amendment. And the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act actually is okay as it stands. It's the amendment part which basically brought a fiscal punishment to agencies if they were determined to be making race-based decisions in terms of placements.
Now, you run programs to take adopted Koreans, now Korean Americans, back to Korea.
Yes.
So why is that work important to you?
It started from a personal perspective. I was adopted from Korea when I was 3 and a half and grew up in Westchester County, about 45 minutes north of New York City. And growing up, I did not have a lot of children of color. I grew up in a predominantly white community. And in college, it became very important for me to begin to understand my racial identity. And even though I knew very clearly who I was personally as Holly McGinnis, as in my family, as soon as I stepped out of my family, I would get inquisitive looks. I would get questions about where did I really come from, and compliments on my English, and expectation that I would be able to speak Korean and Japanese and Chinese and everything. So college was a critical time for me to really begin to understand my own racial identity. And unfortunately, my parents couldn't give me much guidance. But fortunately, the college that I went to, I was able to connect with peers of color and really explore issues of race in the United States. So when I graduated from college, I wanted to start a group because I knew that there was over 150,000 international adoptees just from Korea alone. That doesn't include all the international adoptees from every other country. And I thought that it would be really wonderful to create a mentorship program where these adult adoptees could mentor the next generation of international and transracial families. And one important component of that is understanding where you came from. So sponsoring a motherland trip to Korea was very vital in terms of what I felt adoptees needed to do in terms of exploring all aspects of their identities.
Well, Holly, thank you.
Thank you.
Holly McGinnis is the Policy and Operations Director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute. And we just heard from the organization skeptical of colorblind adoption, but what about people who have been adopted into these situations? Aaron Stigger personifies colorblind adoption. He's African American, and as a young child, he was adopted into a white family in the Chicago area. Now, as a young man, he reflects on what it has meant to be part of a transracial family. To tell us more about his experience, Aaron joins us now. Hey, Aaron.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to have you here in our studios. So you're an actor now and clearly grown. You've been through the walk of childhood. Tell us a little bit about that walk.
The walk was cool. I think my sister and I, who are both biracial, made it a little bit of a hipper walk for my Caucasian parents. But it wasn't that difficult. I think the biggest thing growing up as a kid was explaining that, okay, my mom's white and my dad's white. You know, you come home from class and your mom's there and she makes you a sandwich and she's white. So your friend's like, oh, so your dad must be black. And you're like, kind of, which is kind of true because my birth father's black. So it's not a full lie. But then dad comes home at like 6 o'clock and then you kind of have to explain it. And then it's all good. And then, you know, for the rest of the playtime, you don't have to worry about it. And that was only an issue that I had to confront with new friends. Another issue was walking in the mall with your mom. You know, it's already kind of weird being in the mall with your mom anyway as a kid. But you just feel like a sore thumb. You know, you're not very incognito at the mall. But those two instances are really the only race-related things that I ever had to run across. My mom is my mom and my dad is my dad, and there's nobody else that could take that part. And even though I don't look anything like my parents, I'm more athletic than my parents. It never comes across my mind unless I'm talking about the issue of adoption, that these are my adoptive parents.
What did your parents teach you about race? And I mean everything from black history to attitudes about race. And then what do you think you taught them?
Well, one thing they didn't teach me was how to pick my hair. Dad used the comb, and that's pretty fun because, you know, when white people get their hair wet and you put the comb through it, you get the nice little streaks. When black people get their hair wet, you know, you might get a little bead of water at the top of the fro, but that's about it. So that was a fun learning experience for them because I always wanted the white people's hair. My sister and I tried to mousse our hair back like the people on MTV, and my mom always wanted our hair so that she could pick it and it'd stay like in one shape and whatnot. So there was a lot of things like that. You know, we celebrated Kwanzaa a few years. My mom started to integrate our Christmas tree with black Santas and black angels to the point where there's no white angels anymore. So, you know, I started to incorporate some Native American angels and bring back some of the white angels to the neighborhood, so that we could have a nice
Christmas integration,
multi-ethnic Christmas celebration. You know, the biggest thing that my parents did was to raise my sister and I in a very diverse neighborhood. It's really, really important if you're going to adopt a kid that's a different race to have neighbors that look like that kid. You know, the study that came out, I think, is scaring people and thinking that you're going to have to go through like a 2-year master program to learn how to have black kids if you're white parents. And it's honestly, you could probably knock it out in 2 hours. It's really not that difficult. There's a few things that you should know, and bringing your kids up in a diverse neighborhood is the most important of that. And then, you know, if you have friends that are the same race of your kids, You ask them for questions, and it's helpful to have them as a resource and something that you definitely want to keep next to you when you're raising your kids. My sister and I made my parents cooler by bringing by bringing in some color to the Stigger family. And that's the benefit of it. It is a little more work as a parent, but you get so much more out of it. And it definitely helped me and my sister to have the viewpoints of two white people and still have the viewpoints of us as biracial kids.
If you were talking to someone who was, you know, say 10 years old, what kind of advice would you give that age of person for dealing with an experience like yours?
The most important thing is just to tell them that you have someone to talk to. It's always, you know, even if I don't know the person, I'm always down to let them know, like, here's my email. If ever you need to talk about racial questions or whatnot, you know, I'll type you back. It wasn't a big issue that I had. It was just always helpful to know that there was someone else there that was sharing my story. I never needed to talk to anybody about it, but it was just really comforting in knowing that that I wasn't the only one. And one of the things that my neighborhood, Oak Park, did, which is a suburb of Chicago, was to create a group called Project Unity. And it was just a whole bunch of transracial families that got together every once in a while and just had picnics and just talked. And it was just nice to see that there were other biracial kids out there, other kids that had white parents or parents that were different colors of them. And that was really it. There wasn't any lesson that I needed or advice that I needed. It was just to know that I wasn't the only one out there.
Aaron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Aaron Stigger is an L.A.-based actor, and he spoke with us today from the studios of NPR West. Just ahead, earlier this year, a controversial video made the rounds on the internet. It showed white students in South Africa harassing black university employees. So what's been the fallout? We'll find out on our Africa update. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Ugandan immigrants are the latest group to face attacks in South Africa. Battles over revenues from oil drilling could spark civil war again in Sudan, and a video that degraded black staff at a South African university spurs administrators to shut down an all-white dorm. That's all in our Africa update, and for more, we've got Bill Fletcher. He's a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of TransAfrica Forum. Hey, Bill, great to have you on again.
Always glad to be back.
So we've got a couple stories on South Africa, but let me start with Sudan. There was a 3-year peace accord. It could be melting down. The two factions are the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Sudan People's Liberation Army. Now, that was a 20-year civil war that you have the peace agreement about. 2 million people died. And the same groups are fighting over part of central Sudan. Tell us more about that region.
There's been struggle. We have to keep in mind the way that Africa was divided up by the colonial powers. And so the Sudan was basically designed by the British in a way that brought together the mainly Arab North and the non-Arab South. And after independence, almost immediately, there were struggles between the people in the South versus the government in the North based in Khartoum. Over everything, control of resources. And then by the 1980s, after a peace accord had been breached by the North, further struggles about an attempt by the government to impose a bizarre form of Sharia law, Islamic law, on the people of the South. And there was a war that started.
Now, when you look at the territory, oil is a factor. What do people want? What do these two factions want?
Well, there was a peace accord, as you said, that took place, and everyone was hopeful. I was very hopeful that something was going to work. The problem is that the government of General al-Bashir in Khartoum was less than forthcoming in terms of moving the peace agreement and establishing clear borders. And then the discovery of oil in the southern Sudan made that land that much more valuable. So the government in Khartoum was less interested in a full settlement. The Sudanese People's Liberation Movement, the political arm of the SPLA, had some months ago was prepared to pull out of the unity government because they felt that the Khartoum regime of al-Bashir was really not serious. But then they backed off from that. And then just recently we had this major clash in the Sudan between the armies of their respective forces and essentially what appears to be almost an ethnic cleansing carried out by the Sudanese army against the people from the south in that particular city.
I wonder if there's ever compassion fatigue about a place like Sudan, where you have not only this conflict, but of course, Darfur. And how do you see Americans reacting to this? I mean, there's been a lot of celebrity activism. There's been a lot of, you know, sort of grassroots and intellectual community activism. But how much are ordinary Americans involved in or invested in trying to deal with these issues?
Very important question. We could spend an hour talking about that. And the problem is that, yes, there is a certain level of fatigue that develops, but partly because we don't spend enough time trying to understand the situation. We look for simple answers. So we look at the Sudan sometimes as Islam versus Christianity. And that's not really what's at stake. Or we look at it as the Arabs against the non-Arabs. We don't look at the problems that are the result of the boundaries that were set up. We don't look at the impact of the changing climate. We don't look at the issues of oil. We don't look at a corrupt government that's running the Sudan. So we don't spend the time. And then what happens is we throw up our hands when there are no easy solutions. I think part of what would help, frankly, is more programs like yours, where there's a deeper examination as to the roots of the situation. And I think then people would be less likely to fall into fatigue. But when you're looking for simple answers and they don't arrive, I think people would rather just hide under their pillows.
Here's another case of tough decisions to be made. We have talked about attacks against African immigrants who come to South Africa. Now it seems that there's Ugandan attacks against Ugandans. There have been attacks against Zimbabweans and Mozambicans. There's a new commission by the president to try to look into this attack, this series of attacks. What's that commission trying to do?
Well, this is a situation, Farai, that's been growing since 94, since the end of apartheid and the election of the African National Congress. The problem is this. Fundamentally, the issue of poverty has not been tackled in a satisfactory way by the government. And you've had among the mass of poor people at the bottom, the so-called black Africans, a very high level of patience actually waiting for something to turn around. And it hasn't. Instead, there's been much more emphasis on the development of a black capitalist class, opening up the borders to trade, etc., and not enough paying attention to the grievances of people at the base. When you have a situation like this, it is very easy for opportunists to take advantage of the situation and explode it in a very unproductive way. And that's what happened. So people's anger about their situation was channeled, much like we've seen here in the United States when people go against immigrants. Instead of understanding the way that the system is working and that it needs to be challenged, people start going after the vulnerable groups. So they went after the Zimbabweans. They went after the Mozambicans. They went after the Ugandans. Look, Farai, for years, immigrants have been moving into South Africa, going back to the apartheid era, to work in the mines, to work in various industries. So immigration is not new to South Africa. But when you have the level of frustration and the depth of poverty and wealth polarization, it was a time bomb. It was just a matter of when it was going to blow up.
There was a commentary in allafrica.com that said that poverty is at the root of this. Do you agree with that?
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'd say that, I mean, that there's many roots, and it's very likely that there was a group or grouping that actually incited these pogroms, these attacks. But fundamentally, This is about poverty. This is about frustration. This is about people saying, we've been waiting for more than 10 years, for 14 years, for the fruits of our national liberation struggle to come forward. And we're not seeing it. We're not seeing land distributed the way that it should be. We're not seeing the fundamental changes in water and electricity and other things that we've needed. We've not seen the development of housing on the level that we've needed. And this has just been boiling over. So it's not in any way, please don't misunderstand me, I'm not excusing the attacks on the immigrants. I abhor the attacks on the immigrants, just as I do when immigrants are attacked here. But the problem is that it's not enough for the government to just say this is wrong and it embarrasses South Africa. They've got to start talking about the economic policies that they're following, which are not benefiting the mass of poor people in the country.
Got one final topic, just want to touch on very briefly. If you go to South Africa's Free State, you'll see a controversy over a video that shows white students at a local university. They were feeding middle-aged black workers a stew that appears to include urine. Here's a clip of that scene, which is in Afrikaans. Now, at the end of that video, a message in Afrikaans fills the screen, and it reads in translation, "That, at the end of the day, is what we think of integration." What do you think is the ramification of an incident like this?
Well, I have two feelings, Ryan, and I'm almost embarrassed to say them. On the one hand, I mean, there was really no surprise there. And when you have a country that has gone through years of colonialism and then the apartheid era of white supremacy, of course you're going to have these kind of racists and in many cases fascists that are going to have not disappeared and are going to be there attempting to provoke a situation. So I think it's very important for people to step forward and speak out against this. But my other reaction is this. Why aren't we talking about rape that's going on in South Africa? Why aren't we as angry about the spread of HIV and AIDS? Why is it that our reactions are so incensed when we see something that's actually very predictable? Of course they're going to be racist South Africans. But why aren't we just as furious that black women are being raped in record numbers in South Africa, and that the government seems to feel like there's nothing new under the sun?
Well, Bill, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of TransAfrica Forum. He spoke with us from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters. And for more on the racial tensions at the University of the Free State in South Africa, we've got Zinnie Magubane. She's an associate professor of sociology at Boston College in Newton, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Hi.
So you just heard Bill say, essentially, yes, this is a huge incident, but it doesn't compare with some of the other social issues. Do you think that there's too much focus on this?
No, I don't think that at all. I don't think it's an either-or type of equation. Because in essence, it's not that the outrage against this diminishes the outrage against rape or HIV or AIDS or any of those other things. In fact, I would say that these things, you know, rather than the reaction to those things being disparate, in essence, what people are reacting to is a culture and, a series of events that have at their root a basic disrespect for black life, especially black female life. So you can't really separate something like rape, the AIDS crisis, which disproportionately affects women, and this type of incident where the targets were, you know, poor black women. At their root is essentially the fact that they are continue to be so devalued.
When you think about this incident, there's some reports that they may have been playing a game akin to Fear Factor. Now, there's consent when you say yes, and then there's consent that may come from your situation and be tainted by the fact that you feel you really have no choice. Do you think that even if these women consented to it, that they did it under a kind of duress about their position?
I'm sure. I mean, you really cannot talk about consent in this type of situation, because consent implies that there is some basic equality between the two parties, right? And so these women, many of the news reports said that they had been employed in this particular residence hall, some of them for a long, you know, many, many years, that the school is essentially an Afrikaans institution, that many of the students in this particular residence were privileged students, you know, and also the inequality that comes about through educational background, right? So, you know, it was not a sense that there were two people meeting on the grounds of equality who decided to play this game, but rather, you know, one group of people who purposefully picked, you know, a very weak member of the community. They didn't even go out and target their fellow black students. They went and targeted people that worked for them, you know. So they were very careful that they didn't want to play this so-called game with their fellow black students who most likely would have, you know, refused.
Now, in this case, you have a situation where many people, including South Africa's former president, F.W. de Klerk, have spoken out about this. There's a consensus that this was a bad thing at this moment. But what do you think the underlying cultural issues are? We've been throwing around the term Afrikaans, Afrikaner. How does that longstanding culture and history play into perhaps how this unfolded?
Well, you know, the university where the students who pulled the stunt were studying, you know, it was a university that produced a lot of the civil servants that kind of staffed, you know, the apartheid security branches, its sort of state apparatus, you know, and many of these students, you know, even though they're young, 18, 19, 20, when they were born and the parents they were born to never imagined that they would ever have to live, you know, in terms of equality with African people. And what you're seeing there is people who have come to the profound realization that their era of terror and domination is over. And again, to me, it's so profound that they attacked really what they probably felt were the last group of people that they could successfully lord over, which was these extremely poor women that had to work for them. Again, they didn't have, you know, the, I guess you could say, guts or tenacity or bravery to go after African people on their own level, fellow students, fellow middle-class people, but they directed their ire at that group, which, you know, is essentially the weakest group in the society.
There is a move to turn what was this all-white dorm into a diversity center, and it reminds me of the responses you often have in the U.S., you know, let's form a diversity council, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think something like this is going to work?
You know, it can't hurt in the sense that, you know, what has to be communicated loud and clear after an incident like this is that, first of all, that they don't work. That attempt to intimidate people, attempt to roll back the, you know, the chain of progress is simply not going to work. And secondly, that it's important to assert not only that that's not going to work, but what the future is going to be, you know. So whether you call a diversity center or, you know, a series of lectures or what have you, what they need to be communicating, it's not so much the event itself of the diversity center, but rather a clear communication of blacks and whites are going to live on conditions of equality in this country.
Do you think that in the future, incidents like this, even if they happen, that there will be more oversight that may have put an end to this sooner, because it's been playing out over several months?
I think so. I mean, I think that these experiences, again, they tend to get spectacularized, you know, and day-to-day things like, you know, at other universities, it might not have had these type of, you know, well-known explosive incidents, maybe like a University of Cape Town or University of the Witwatersrand. Still, you know, it's well-known on those campuses that once the dorms or the residences are for blacks, once they integrated, white students moved out. They didn't perform those same sort of stunts, but they still, you know, walked out in protest that they didn't want to live, you know, side by side with blacks. So I think that, you know, when these incidents happen, you know, they kind of shed a light on something that's kind of insidious in a lot of different universities. And again, the message that gets sent is that we're not going backwards on this. you know, that we know it's going to take time. You know, we know that it's not going to happen overnight, but universities will be integrated spaces. This country will be an integrated country where, again, black and whites have to live side by side with mutual respect.
Zinni, thank you.
Thank you.
Zinni Magubane is an associate professor of sociology at Boston College. And next on News and Notes, some black judges say it's challenging to face black defendants in their courtroom. We get the scoop from our contributor, Judge Lynn Toler. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. A black judge in Atlanta got into trouble recently. He asked a group of white lawyers to leave the courtroom. Then Superior Court Judge Marvin Arrington gave a room full of black defendants a tongue-lashing, asking them to think about and change the downward spiral of their lives. Judge Arrington later called his actions a mistake, but he also said he felt he couldn't talk to the defendants effectively with whites in the room. So right now we turn to our own judge and contributor, Lynn Toler. She says Judge Arrington's conduct brings up key questions about how black judges bring their own racial views into the system. Judge Toler is with us now. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. So, you know, a lot of us, I think, frankly, almost all of us who are African-American say, you know what, I need to, you know, each one teach one, lift somebody up. But when you're a judge, you have a very particular role, and it's a role where you are at somewhat of a remove. Even though you're facing the defendants, you are not on the same level with them. How do you make sense of what Judge Arrington did?
I understand what Judge Arrington did completely. And I have to tell you why. Though we must be removed, we are nonetheless human. It is the easiest thing in the world to do is to be removed if you don't care. But if you have the nerve to care, and if you see what we see on a daily basis, his humanity and his caring came together that day and made him do something clearly he shouldn't have done. He knows that, but it was an error of the heart that I find fully condonable.
So what other ways, you know, you say that you approve of the sentiment, not necessarily of the execution. How else Right. may he have gone about this?
I think he could have said it in front of the white judges, in front of the white attorneys. In my courtroom, I for a year and a half wouldn't say anything directed towards a defendant that had anything to do with race because I felt it was inappropriate. But my second thought about it was, my job is to deal with this individual as best I can. And if I feel that I can touch him, reach him, get to him by mentioning, dealing with, or encompassing race in the conversation, I have an obligation to do so. And I can't worry about what white people are out there looking at me, because my job is with respect to him. So I say it.
You know, this issue hit home with you recently during the taping of your show, Divorce Court. Tell us what happened.
What happened is I broke one of my mother's rules, and my mother's rule is don't let your emotions straddle events. I had come home, I had come to work, and my husband was in the emergency room when I called home. One son was sick and the other one wasn't going to school. And I had my three wonderful men at home. I'm not taking care of them. And I got a third defendant there that day that was talking about how many babies he had with how many different black women, not only with a sense of shame, but with a sense of accomplishment. And with the backdrop of my great men that I live with, and there are so many great brothers out there who I wasn't taking care of, and this guy, the third guy that day that took pride in that which he was doing that was damaging his women and me, I took it personally. I got upset. I lost my composure. And I said something, and I said a whole lot of stuff, actually, and I wasn't sure what I said, and I made him play it back to me because I was afraid that I may have said something. I might have had an Arrington moment where my and I hope not to brand the brother with that because I love him and I understand what he did, but I may have gone too far. And I wanted to have an opportunity, which is great. You can do it on TV, but you can't do it in real life, to review what you said in a moment of passion.
So give me an example of what you said, not necessarily the language, but the meaning, the intent of what you said.
Is this it? Is this all I get? I took it personally, me to you, is this the best we can do as a people? Is this the best you can do for me as a brother to a sister? Are we going to live down to the expectations of those people who disdain us? That was my message. My language was quite different. And I was afraid that my passion and my desire would get lost, got somehow lost in the anger that I was feeling.
Now, there's also the toll, you know, that this takes on judges. I mean, that's precisely what Judge Arrington said. He said, seeing the same black faces walk in and out of his courtroom year after year takes its toll. When you first became a judge in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, did you feel like it was something that you brought home with you, that you felt a weight on yourself?
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, I'm a control freak and I'm goal-oriented. I took recidivism personally. Every time I saw that same guy or some woman come back in, it was a failure on my part. And I did, and it hurt me. And I've cried. I've made defendants cry. I had the whole courtroom crying once because my sense of hurt was so real and so immediate. And everybody talks about the problem in general, or they're dealing with one person. I used to get the individual en masse, day after day after day. And after a while, if you don't care, it's fine. But once you do care, it is exasperating, exhausting, and you feel a sense of complete impotence in dealing with the issue.
What do you think about the debate that goes on in our community around this? Because Judge Arrington has now appeared in an event with Bill Cosby, who's been a big critic of
right.
what he sees as the negative sides of black behavior. So when you look at this, you look at your experience with seeing the same people go in and out of court, with having people come on your show and disrespect the idea of trying. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the debate that's going on right now in our community is going to produce change, or could it divide us where some people say, I don't need your judgments?
I don't like the way the debate is going. And I tell you why. I think it's divisive. What Bill Cosby did is what Bill Cosby did. He could have stayed home with his millions and his wife and put his feet up on the table and done nothing. He was making an effort to make change. I read his book and I read the response to his book. In the response to his book, or some gentleman, and I can't remember his name, he said, I urge patience in the middle class as being indignant inappropriately. But Bill was caring. Now, whether or not his care was appropriate, I don't know. Whether it's going to be helpful, I don't know. But it at least starts the conversation. To attack him as being, the middle class, as if the middle class, having been successful, has abandoned blackness. And I think the way the debate is going is frightening. And my question to the people who respond to Bill Cosby, as you shouldn't have said it, is, what now? I mean, what do we do instead? And if you got something for me, let me know.
I think we're all thinking about it and working on it. But I just wonder if, you know, do you think that the defendants who've come in to your courtroom have a sufficient social network so that they see other people doing better or you know, improving their lives so that they can even have anything to pattern it on?
Absolutely. And I think that's a huge part of the problem. And what I would do in my court, I had a program for men and a program for women, because even if I spark something in you with what I say, you're going to go back into an environment where everybody's telling you something else. And I don't have the ability, that constant contact. So what I think is at least a part of the solution is when we do something, to take a small group and to stay with them. I stayed with a group of girls for a year at a time for over a decade, and I did see two or three people who called me a couple years later, Judge, I just want to tell you how well I am doing. It's not a great answer. It's not the answer everybody wants to hear, because it's not a panacea, and it's work intensive while the success rate is low, but I think it's what has to be done.
Judge, always great to talk to you.
Always.
That was News and Notes contributor Judge Lynn Toler. She's a former municipal court judge and now hosts the syndicated television show Divorce Court. She joined us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. With his rectangular guitar, Bo Diddley reshaped rock and roll. He died yesterday of heart failure at the age of 79. Born Ellis Otha Bates in Mississippi in 1928, Diddley influenced musicians like Buddy Holly, Bruce Springsteen, and the Rolling Stones. We've got music blogger and marketing executive Rob Fields to talk about Bo Diddley's contribution to American music. Rob blogs about black rock at boldaslove.us. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me again, Farai. How are you today?
I'm doing great. So people like Bo Diddley and Little Richard and Chuck Berry are royalty in the rock music world. And some people forget that African Americans were the original pioneers of rock and roll. Why was Bo Diddley important?
Bo Diddley was important because he did something that was completely unheard of at the time, and that was he used his guitar as a percussion instrument, not as melody or color, but as something that was an extension of what drums would be doing. So his famous Bo Diddley beat, that bump, 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 you know, has been used for music throughout the last 40 years. And it has been in songs as diverse as, you know, Not Fade Away by Buddy Holly, on up to I Want Candy by the Strangeloves, to The Stooges 1969, to Faith by George Michael, to U2's Desire. I mean, the list goes on.
I actually want to play you a little bit of Led Zeppelin, because recently we talked on our show about the ways that that group appropriated blues and early black rock. So, you know, Led Zeppelin added a little bit of, there was a heavy bottom and a, you know, fullness to Led Zeppelin's sound.
Right.
But, you know, how do you think a group like that, you mentioned so many already, and now I have I Want Candy stuck in my brain, but but how do you think Bo Diddley influenced Led Zeppelin?
I mean, I think that that whole, I mean, part of the Led Zeppelin mystique was sort of Robert Plant's frontman status. And Bo Diddley's also known for his sort of larger than life personality, his braggadocio, his, what shall we call this, self-mythologizing. You know, I mean, you see it today in artists like Kanye West. But he was this kind of dangerous guy, you know, and that was his persona. I mean, he's a nice guy, but his onstage persona was dangerous. And sort of full of sexual come on. And, you know, that was a lot of the Led Zeppelin mystique.
Speaking of the sexuality, how do you think that was perceived culturally during the era when, you know, really African-Americans created and ruled rock and roll and yet were so popular with a multiracial audience?
It really, I think, hurt him because was more palatable to white audiences was sort of the more sexually ambiguous artist, you know, sort of like, you know, Little Richard. I mean, Little Richard was not sort of this threatening black man. You know, he was sort of flamboyant and sort of more of a showman kind of thing. But that really hurt him. And in fact, there's one story where Bo Diddley almost got into a fight with Ed Sullivan because of some misunderstandings on the Ed Sullivan show about what song he was supposed to play. Ed Sullivan wanted him to play one song, but he wanted to do his Bo Diddley song, so that's what he did. And Ed Sullivan ended up calling him boy and said, boy, you, first time a black boy has double-crossed me. I mean, they had to pull Bo Diddley out of there because he was about to jump on Ed Sullivan.
Wow. Well, you know, we've talked about how Bo Diddley affected the paths of white musicians, but also there's a black rock movement. It was started really in the 1980s with the Black Rock Coalition. You helped play a role in its creation. And now we've seen something where there are new black rock acts emerging. Spoken word artist and actor Saul Williams' CD, The Inevitable Rise and Liberation of Niggy Tardust, is getting critical acclaim. We can be as one tonight. Now, that's his rendition of the U2 classic Bloody Sunday. So how do you see things kind of going in full circle right now with the evolution of rock out of the African-American community and kind of a reclaiming of it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that, you know, we are in the midst of this huge cultural shift right now. And, you know, Barack Obama is only the largest and most visible aspect of that. But one of the things that Bo Diddley represented was this artist who was very clear from the beginning that he wanted to do his own thing and have his own sound. He was clear that he did not want to sound like anyone else. And what you're finding now, particularly amongst black rock artists and black audiences, is they want artists to be individuals and create a new sound, and they don't want them to be cookie cutter. And that's what black rock artists in the larger sense of the term have always been about, sort of exploring their own personal taste, but filtering it certainly through, you know, a black cultural sensitivity, but, you know, really embracing the fullness of American music and international music and just being themselves.
Give me a quick hit on how you think the internet and iPods are changing the game.
Oh, my God. I mean, this cultural shift is being driven by the internet, by broadband connections, by the fact that, you know, you can find and more easily discover music today than at any point in the past. Certainly, it's also being driven by, you know, these what we call the millennial generation, you know, folks in their 20s who have much different attitudes than the boomers did about race and gender and sexuality, and just their whole attitude is sort of beginning to be felt. And so that's opening up areas of experimentation, of music discovery from one person to another on an individual basis is happening even as we speak.
And you can get yourself a little Bo Diddley while you're at it. Rob, thanks.
Thank you.
Rob Fields is a marketing executive. He also blogs about black rock at boldaslove.us. He joined us from our NPR studios in New York City.
Oh, yeah. How am I doing? Take my hand, baby.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, the Democratic primary season could be wrapping up. NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving joins us to look at the last of the primaries and the future of the general election.
Goodbye. I've got to put you down. I'll see you someday. Baby, somewhere hanging around.